And if there is a dispute where there's these multiple slate of electors, well, then the one that met that safe harbor requirement is the one that gets counted. So essentially, it seems primed to give the electoral votes cast for former Vice President Biden on Mondays, the ones that are certified, that are seen as official, those will be preferenced in any sort of dispute, so long as Congress sticks to that Electoral Count Act formula.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, December 16th, 2020. And when I say it is December 16th, I mean that it is 2 days after the Electoral College has met in 50 state capitals and voted and given 306 electoral votes to Joe Biden, making him the next president of the United States. Or did it? Because there is talk of a kind of electoral Alamo wherein a final showdown takes place over the counting of those electoral votes come January 6th, when Congress meets in a joint session of Congress to receive the votes of the state electors. We thought we would get together in the virtual jungle studio to chew over what happened this week. Is the election actually over, or are we heading toward some kind of final cataclysm where the forces of Trumpism take on the last stage of the electoral process? Joining me are our congressional guru, Molly Reynolds, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, and Scott Anderson, Lawfare senior editor and fellow at the Brookings Institution. It's the Lawfare Podcast, December 16th. It's over, or is it? Molly, get us started. What happened on Monday, and is the election finally over?
So on Monday, in as you said in the intro, in each of the 50 state capitals around the country, we had the formal casting of the votes in the Electoral College. And then from there, those certifications will proceed to come to Washington in preparation for Congress counting them on January 6th. Lots of folks, I certainly watched some of these live on C-SPAN. It's good television for electoral nerds. But I would say that at this point, it really is over. We can talk kind of more specifically about what will happen on January 6th, that we can talk about reasons that the process of casting and counting the Electoral College votes probably does need some reforms. But given the circumstances of this year, I would say that at this point, now that the Electoral College has cast its votes, and Joe Biden has, as you said, won 306 of them, that it's all over but the formal act of counting them in Washington on January 6th.
All right. Scott, you have, for your sins in life, which must have been many for you to have had to take on this penance, studied the question of counting electoral votes pretty closely under the completely Byzantine Electoral Count Act. So walk us through it. We like to say that, you know, the formal election takes place when the Electoral College meets and the electors vote, but there is this part that happens afterwards. So do you agree with Molly that it's over, there's no capacity for mischief in this last phase, or is it more complicated than that?
It's a difficult question. You know, I think there is still some outside potential for mischief, but I think actually the thing that probably put the nail on the coffin is not just the casting electoral votes, but the signal by Senate Majority Leader McConnell that he appears to be accepting the election results, and a number of other Senate Republicans as well. And we can get to why in a second. But I do think that the participation by one chamber or the other would be necessary to facilitate any sort of the mischief that's left on the table. But I think it's worth taking a step back to note one interesting development that got a little bit of media attention, but not much, which is that in some of the quote unquote disputed states that are where there is still, or was until recently at least, litigation ongoing about the election results, we actually saw not one but two slates of electors cast electoral votes, or at least try and cast electoral votes. There was some footage, if people were watching, of Republican electors for President Trump trying to walk in and cast their own set of electoral votes. And reports by Stephen Miller and other people close to the president indicated that there was an intent for them to cast their own electoral votes on Monday and send them along to the Congress as well, alongside the official certified slate of electoral votes. And the reason they're doing this is because there's actually precedent for this in cases of disputed elections. And kind of the one modern case of a disputed election we have, which was Hawaii in 1960, where it's unclear whether Hawaii had actually voted for President Kennedy or then Vice President Nixon, the dispute was still actually ongoing in the Hawaii state courts on the date on which the electors were supposed to cast the electoral votes. So what they ended up doing is that they actually both cast individual slates of electoral votes and sent them on to Congress. At the time, if I recall correctly, it looked like Vice President Nixon had carried the state by something like 150 votes. But after a recount and further judicial proceedings, it actually turned out that President Kennedy carried the state. But that conclusion wasn't reached until after the date that electoral votes were cast. What ended up happening is that the governor of Hawaii changed the governor's certification on the basis of that judicial ruling by the state Supreme Court. And the Congress ended up voting by both chambers by unanimous consent, as I recall correctly, at Vice President Nixon's suggestion, to recognize and accept the other set of electors that was electoral votes that was not certified on the date on which the votes were cast, meaning the electoral votes cast for President Kennedy. This is notable because it's really the only precedent we have for this sort of situation, and at least opens the door for the possibility that you might see some sort of future judicial proceeding kicking the door open to counting these alternative Trump slate of electors. Although, for reasons I'm going to get to in just a second, it's extremely, extremely narrow slash probably non-existent at this point, but at least a hypothetical possibility. And this is why me and among other people, when we were writing about this before the election, said, you know, if these disputes are still ongoing, there's a good chance that you'll see two slates of electors go forward. And it looks like that's what more or less happened on Monday, in at least some of these states, or at least there was an effort to do so. The reason why it's really narrow is what you mentioned in your question, the Electoral Count Act, which is the statute in place that decides the rules on which the Congress will be counting the electoral votes as they come in. And it actually is specifically designed to address exactly the scenario where multiple slates of electors cast multiple sets of electoral votes from a given state, because that was actually the kind of most common occurrence in the 19th century when the law was passed, when you had disputed elections. What it says essentially is that whichever set of electoral votes is cast by a set of electors that were determined by state procedures to have the right to be the electors, be the rightly selected electors, by the safe harbor date, which is 6 days before the date the votes are cast, so December 8th this year, they will be given credit as the votes that are properly counted by Congress. Now, the Hawaii case seems to deduce maybe a little bit of a curveball here. There's some ability for Congress to overrule its own rules. In that case, again, by unanimous consent, that's not unusual for Congress to be able to pass exceptions to some of their procedural rules, which essentially this law is. It's not clear it has any more binding authority on Congress than a set of procedural rules. And it's notable, it gets kind of incorporated by reference into the resolutions that the House and the Senate pass when they start the joint sessions to count the laws. But nonetheless, this formula says essentially, if that slate of electors comes forward, that's the one that gets counted. And if there is a dispute where there's these multiple slate of electors, well, then the one that met that safe harbor requirement is the one that gets counted. So essentially, it seems primed to give the electoral votes cast for former Vice President Biden on Mondays, the ones that are certified, that are seen as official, those will be preferenced in any sort of dispute, so long as Congress sticks to that Electoral Count Act formula.
All right. So let's talk about what such an Alamo situation would look like. And then we will come back to McConnell's statement today. But Molly, imagine for a moment that the Trump bitter enders decided to have a showdown January 6th. What does that look like?
So let's maybe start by walking through kind of what actually happens on January 6th. So on January 6th, the House and the Senate will convene in a joint meeting to count the electoral votes. The president of the Senate, that's the vice president, Mike Pence, will preside over that session. There is some precedent for him choosing not to if he doesn't want to. In 1969, the president pro tempore of the Senate, which in this case would be Chuck Grassley, presided over the counting of the electoral votes in the absence of the vice president. But let's assert that it'll be Mike Pence. The first thing that happens is that he opens and presents the certificates in alphabetical order of the states. Those certificates are read by what are called tellers. There will be two from each chamber. It's usually the chair and the ranking member of the Senate Rules Committee and the House Administration Committee, which in this case, would make it most likely to be in the House, Zoe Lofgren and Rodney Davis, and in the Senate, Roy Blunt and Amy Klobuchar. As those certificates are read and counted by the tellers, we may see objections made to the states as they are counted. And this may happen even if there isn't a clear kind of political path to actually challenging the votes. We've seen a number of times, including in 2017, folks raise objections. The catch is that for an objection to be actually considered, it needs to be signed by one main member from each chamber. So you need to get at least one House member and at least one senator on board with an objection for it to go beyond just, in this case, a Republican standing up and saying, I object.
And so wait, so when you say that you need a member from each chamber, what form does the objection take? Is it two people simply standing up and saying, I object?
So it it needs to be in writing with a signature. So it needs to be presented and must be signed by at least one senator and one representative. And I'm quoting here, the objection shall state clearly and concisely and without argument the ground thereof. So someone, if you're going to make the objection, you have to articulate the grounds on which you're making the objection. And as I was saying, in previous recent years, including in 2017, you've seen folks try to raise objections from just one House, an attempt to use that opportunity to make a speech, at which point the presiding officer has stopped them from doing so. There's you can watch video of then Vice President Biden doing this to fellow Democrats in 2017. And so most of the kind of conversation that we've heard so far about the possibility of objections to particular states' electoral votes has come from House Republicans, led primarily by Representative Mo Brooks of Alabama. You've heard a couple of Senate Republicans be kind of non-committal around whether they would join any of their House colleagues' objections. But to sort of return to something that Scott was saying earlier about kind of the political importance of Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell coming out and congratulating President-elect Biden, I think that takes some of the potential wind out of the sails, not all of it. There are obviously plenty of instances where individual Republican senators have bucked McConnell for one reason or another. But unless you get a Republican senator to join with one or more Republican House members to actually file a written objection, then any kind of verbal objections that we see would be when someone stands up, objects, and then it is not in order for them to continue speaking.
Okay, so let's break that down. So Mo Brooks recruits, who do we think is the most likely Republican senator to join this? Ted Cruz, Josh Hawley, or somebody else, right? Recruits somebody else to join him in a written series of objections for all the electors from all the battleground states, and repeats the words fraud a lot in written objections, and they submit these. What then happens? Presumably they want recognition of these alternative Republican slates of electors. So Scott, walk us through what happens here. I mean, it's you need 1% of the Senate to join less than a quarter of 1% of the House in a written objection. Then what happens?
Sure. Well, you know, I'll invite Molly to correct me, but my understanding of this at this point is essentially when you have an objection that's lodged, you will essentially the two chambers, instead of engaging in debate as part of the kind of joint session that they're at which they're counting the votes, the Electoral Act says no, you actually divide up into the House and Senate, where you have a fixed period of, I believe, 2 hours in which you're supposed to debate the particular issue, presumably as presented by the co-signer of the objection, who then can provide whatever explanation they may want to provide. And then are supposed to come back together to further debate it. The Electoral Count Act also puts a bunch of other restrictions on this proceeding. They basically set certain time limits, particularly if a number of days have gone by since the session to count the votes have started. A number of other efforts really restrain the ability to drag it out indefinitely. But there is this substantial capability to at least delay and drag out this procedure by potentially forcing these reversions to these kind of separate sessions, particularly if there is enough support or enough inclination to keep these debates and let them happening over and over again, as opposed to resolving them relatively quickly. So it kind of depends a little bit there in terms of how receptive the individual bodies, particularly the Senate, is to have some of these separate sort of debates. The real truth, though, is it's not clear that there is a route towards counting the Trump slate of electors without the House, so long as they abide by the Electoral Count Act formula. Again, the only place where we've seen it happen that they've discarded, you know, one slate of electors for another is this Hawaii case, which, again, the facts just don't line up here. There's no sign of any judicial ruling coming down in Trump's favor or any other effort that would lead one of the governors of these states to change their certification to the other slate of electors. And even then, that would cause some questions under the Electoral Count Act. So without the House, which, because it's under Democratic control, seems extremely unlikely to vote against Biden's slate of electors in any scenario where there's not, you know, absent clear evidence of fraud that just doesn't exist, as far as we can tell, you are not going to see that sort of flip. Instead, you know, the only real option available, and it's a real Hail Mary bordering on, you know, a bit of a Pyrrhic victory, perhaps, is just trying to obstruct the presidential selection process in hopes that by January 20th, no new president is selected. At which point, President Trump leaves office, but you have this Presidential Succession Act under which there are some readings that some people maintain you might be able to keep one of President Trump's cabinet members in office as the acting president.
Yeah, we'll return to that scenario. We might call it the Pompeo scenario in a moment. But Molly.
Yeah, so I just want to add a couple things to what Scott was saying about sort of the procedure. So Scott's absolutely right that the authors of the Electoral Count Act in 1887 actually did something that is one of the first cases in American history where Congress wrote some procedures for debate that are actually meant to speed up the process of debate. So Scott was mentioning that the procedures that both the House and the Senate would use to debate and vote on objections, if an objection was properly delivered with the signature of one House member, or at least one House member and at least one senator, those procedures limit debate on the objection to not more than 2 hours. And during those 2 hours, each member may speak only once and for not more than 5 minutes. And so that is really, particularly when we think about the Senate and its tradition of unlimited debate, it's actually important here because it as I was saying, in the late 19th century, this was one of the first times that kind of Congress looked at its procedures and said, hey, this is something that's important enough that we want to write some special rules to try to make this move as quickly as possible. And on the sort of question of the Electoral Count Act, and I'll defer back to Scott on this to correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding of the Electoral Count Act is actually one of the things that it was written to anticipate was basically what happens if more than one slate of electors is received, and that if the House and the Senate disagree about which electoral votes should count. So if we have this objection, the House and the Senate withdraw from the joint meeting, go into their separate rooms to debate and vote on these objections, that there's a preference under the Electoral Count Act for the electors whose appointment has been certified by the executive of the state, which would suggest that the slate of electors certified by the state's governor is the one that controls. Am I right about that, Scott?
Yes, I believe that's right. It actually wouldn't even get to that level where you look to the governor's certification if there is a slate of electors, as there is here, that meets the safe harbor requirement and retains the certification. It's actually the safe harbor requirement as the first order that ticks off saying this is the one that gets preference. But as kind of the last tiebreaker, once you go through this multi-step formula, it ultimately is the act looks to, although there's some debate under which scenario exactly it looks to, but it generally looks to say, okay, if there's no other agreement here, which slate of electors gets counted, it is the one that the governor certifies.
Okay, I want to nail this down. Two members, one from each house, submit a written objection. This triggers 2 hours of debate in which everybody can speak only once. So you have 2 hours of yelling and screaming about voter fraud and a bunch of yelling and screaming about respecting the outcome of the election and there being no evidence of fraud, et cetera, et cetera. After 2 hours, what precisely happens in the way of a vote over accepting these challenged electoral votes? What does Congress have to do in order to throw them out or to accept a different slate of electors?
So again, each house is meeting separately here to debate the objection. Both houses must vote separately to agree or to accept the objection to say, yes, we think that this objection is correct. And that's a simple majority vote in both houses. And then if that does not happen, then the objection has failed and the votes as read by the tellers before the objection was heard are counted. Scott, am I missing anything there?
No, I think that's basically right. The one wild card that we do have to put in here, although I think it's, again, one of these more wild scenarios that one can conceive of, is that there is this kind of a little bit of an open legal question as to what extent the Electoral Count Act procedures can really be binding on Congress. They are exercises of the rulemaking authority of Congress, not the legislative authority. And in theory, you know, each Congress has the constitutional authority to set up its own rules, and each chamber can set up its own rules, adopt amendments, exceptions. And so there may, in theory, be ways to work around them in this case. And there have occasionally been objections that, well, these aren't really binding on Congress. We're not obligated to stick by these. And maybe people could make hay out of this to say, here's a reason why we should be able to obstruct a particular set of electors from being counted or shift it from one direction or the other. Although it's hard to see that happening when you don't control both chambers, at least, where the two chambers don't agree. That said, just that one argument could be hanging over this. And it's something that some people have postured, maybe Vice President Pence claiming some constitutional authority in ruling on particular motions or in determining how he counts the electoral votes will turn towards that sort of argument to say, this is why we need to count these a different way than the Electoral Count Act anticipates. Any effort like that would be unprecedented. It would be really destabilizing because it's not very clear it's right. It's also not entirely clear whether the Supreme Court or other institution would want to intervene in this sort of case. But I think it's worth noting here that this is where the concurrent resolution that starts the session kind of comes into play a little bit, because at least in recent memory, all those resolutions have basically incorporated the Electoral Count Act by reference and said, hey, the Electoral Count Act, the statute establishes the rules that we're going to apply in this session. And so at least in theory, I would think that, you know, if they wanted to depart from those rules, for at least from the outset, you know, you would have to get the House and the Senate on the same page in terms of whatever change from the rules they want to do if they do want to supersede the Electoral Count Act. And so far, that hasn't happened. Both chambers have been satisfied with sticking with those procedures. But it is a theoretical possibility, I think we have to acknowledge.
Yeah, and it's also worth noting that the caveat that Scott draws about kind of the rulemaking power of Congress is applies in many situations, but that it's also the case that the Electoral Count Act prohibits not just debate on objections, but the offering and consideration of almost all questions. And so the statute states that there's no question is to be, quote, put by the presiding officer except to either house on a motion to withdraw. Exactly what that means is less important than just the idea that Congress did not intend for this to be a venue of kind of significant legislative debate. It really set up these procedures to, as I understand it, to kind of provide some regularity to the process, but not for the counting of the electoral votes to be like other legislative sessions that that Congress has.
Okay, so let me see if I can boil this down. Unless Congress is willing to change the rules by not incorporating the Electoral Count Act into the concurrent rules resolution organizing the chambers, all that Nancy Pelosi needs to do to ensure that Joe Biden becomes president is hold her caucus together in one house. Is that fair?
I think that's basically right. You know, it'd be a different story if the chambers were both under Republican control. But I don't see, Al-Amali, correct me if I'm wrong, a real route forward to changing the outcome of the electoral vote count on the basis of the Electoral Count Act, or really even outside of it, while the House is under Democratic control and remains solidified. Again, really, at that point, the only option is to derail the process instead of tipping in a different direction.
Yeah, I don't see a way to do it either. And I think that, frankly, at this point, we really are talking about not just hinging on the fact that Democrats control the House, but we have sort of disturbingly late in the process, but we have at this point in the process started to see a number of Republicans in the Senate express skepticism about paths forward for challenging the results of the election. There are even, I think, a number of House Republicans who are less enthusiastic about kind of going all in on this effort at this point. And so it really is, as I said at the top, I think all over but the formal act of counting.
All right, which brings us to Mitch McConnell, who, as Molly mentioned, announced today that congratulated the president-elect and thereby signaled that there would not be a significant opposition to his election in the January 6th, at least not on the part of the Senate leadership. So do you take this, Molly, to be Mitch McConnell's way of saying, look, I can't control what nutsoids in the House do, but the Senate is going to treat this as a formal exercise of, in the way that it did in 2000, you know, and Mike Pence will, I expect Mike Pence to sit there in a dignified fashion and preside over the reading of his and Donald Trump's electoral defeat, or am I reading too much into it?
No, I think that's probably right. And it, to me, it's probably also a signal to some folks in his own conference who might be sympathetic to House Republicans' interest in raising objections. You mentioned a couple folks before. Ron Johnson of Wisconsin, Rand Paul of Kentucky have also been, you know, rumored as the kinds of folks who might be open to joining with some House members. So I see it as much a message to, again, the members of his own conference that there's no path forward here. This is a formal exercise that we will go through in January, but that it's not worth even having the House and the Senate split to consider formal objections, because at that point, some number of Republican senators would join with Democratic senators to vote down the objection. The Democratic-controlled House would vote down the objection, and it would just be a distraction at that point from proceeding with the peaceful transfer of power from President Trump to President-elect Biden.
All right, let us all be very humble and remember that things have been known occasionally to spin out of control, and accepting everything that Molly and Scott have said so far about how it's over, I want to sketch out a scenario in which it turns out not to be over, which is, Scott alluded to earlier, the Mike Pompeo scenario. So here's how it goes. Molly and Scott assure everybody that it's over, but one person who does not listen to the Lawfare podcast is the President of the United States, Donald Trump, who goes on a tweet storm demanding that members show their commitment to the cause by challenging electoral votes. He spends the next 3 weeks ginning up pressure, which catches on, as it already has to some degree in conservative media, and members face thus a kind of litmus test of their purity in the Trumpist cause, and the acid test is whether they are prepared to challenge electoral votes. This generates enough pressure that while Mitch McConnell is saying all the right things today, 3 weeks from now, he is under consistent pressure from his caucus to lead this charge. And he never won to fail the center of gravity of his caucus, thus does it. And the result is a certain degree of chaos because the House votes one way and the Senate votes another way, and you have challenges to the electoral vote counting and to the necessity of following the Electoral Count Act's rules. And the result is that by January 20th, it is actually not clear that the House and the Senate have endorsed 270 electoral votes for anybody. So, Scott, my question is, is that scenario merely extremely implausible, or is it actually impossible? And if so, why is it impossible? And if not, do we end up with a Speaker Pelosi or a Speaker Pompeo?
Well, I do think that scenario is incredibly implausible, but I don't think it's necessarily impossible. You know, these institutional proceedings that are required to determine who the constitutional president-elect is after January 6th or whichever date the counting takes place, Congress can actually change that and has done so occasionally in the past. But whenever that date comes, you have to complete certain procedures, including the vice president reading the results of the electoral counts and things like that, that you could see certain actors who are really dead set on upsetting the practice simply refuse to comply with. And you could see if it was just one or two people, like Vice President Pence, if he were to refuse to participate, as Molly mentioned before, it's possible the Senate and the House would say, okay, the president pro tempore of the Senate can step in and we think that's acceptable and they may cooperate. But if you get a critical mass of people, you know, I don't think it's impossible that you would see the House or the Senate potentially just walk out of the joint session and refuse to proceed. You know, that's actually kind of what some scholars have pointed to as a safeguard in the system that prevents either chamber from drifting too far, or using too much leverage to try and force an outcome, because the other one can just stop the process. And since the 20th Amendment was adopted in the 1930s, we've had a drop dead date on the presidential administration. That's January 20th. On January 20th, President Trump stops being president and Vice President Pence stops being vice president. And then the question of who becomes the president, or I should say the acting president, really falls to a matter of statute. And that statute currently is the Presidential Succession Act, which says the presidency goes in a sort of acting status, meaning only until we can figure out who the actual winner of the prior election was by some eventually getting Congress to complete that process of counting electoral votes. It'll pass from the president to the vice president if there is a vice president who's confirmed and confirmable. But assuming that's not an option as well, it'll go down instead to the Speaker of the House and then the president pro tempore of the Senate and then cabinet members in order of seniority. So starting with the Secretary of State and then on to Secretary of Treasury, Secretary of Defense, Attorney General, and so on, all the way down to the Secretary of Homeland Security, as I recall. I think I have that order right. The issue here is that there's a constitutional debate about some situations in which that statute would apply. The original constitutional language in Article 2 that allows for Congress to enact these sorts of laws accounting for presidential succession talks in terms of officers, what officers will succeed the presidency. And a lot of people have interpreted that to mean only members of the executive branch can sit in the line of succession in the presidency. And on that basis, they have said, well, this Presidential Succession Act is unconstitutional insofar as it tries to put the Speaker of the House and the President pro tempore of the Senate in the White House. Instead, it should go directly from, if the President and Vice President are unavailable, directly to the Secretary of State, who in this case would be Mike Pompeo, and that he should become the acting president. And it's notable, and this is a scenario that our own Jack Goldsmith, with a co-author, wrote about in a separate context in regards to COVID, potentially, if COVID were to incapacitate the President and Vice President. It's conceivable that Attorney General Barr, or his replacement now, might issue an opinion to the executive branch saying that this constitutional view of the Presidential Succession Act is correct, that the Speaker of the House and the President pro tempore of the Senate are constitutionally not qualified to fill this role, and that therefore the Secretary of State should be treated instead as the acting president. The executive branch would arguably be compelled to kind of play along with that, because the Attorney General is supposed to interpret the law for the executive branch, and his views, unless superseded by the president, are generally binding on executive branch officials. That doesn't mean everybody else has to accept it, but the executive branch may accept it. I do think there's a problem with this argument, though, and that is that insofar as the Presidential Succession Act is not dealing with the case of the death or the incapacity of a president and vice president, but is instead dealing with the situation of what the statute describes as a failure to qualify of any individual for the presidency, that statute's actually not relying on Article 2 of the Constitution, which doesn't address that sort of scenario or give Congress the authority to address that sort of scenario. Instead, it's relying on the 20th Amendment, which addresses the scenario of what happens if this January 20th date that the same amendment installed comes, nobody's in office, and it gives Congress the power to enact a statute for that particular scenario. And notably, unlike Article 2, the 20th Amendment speaks not in terms of officers, but in terms of persons, and uses the same term, it's worth noting, to say, well, to establish rules governing what should happen if presidential and vice presidential candidates should die in office and need to be replaced. Obviously, you wouldn't assume that presidential and vice presidential candidates would have to be replaced by a member of the incumbent cabinet, because that person might not be a member of the same party, might be a member of the opposite side of that election. So the idea that persons would be limited in the same definition as officers, as some people read officers, I don't think carries water. Now, I should say this is my view. This may not be a universal view. John Yoo, among others, published a Wall Street Journal op-ed suggesting that he believed that Secretary Pompeo would have the stronger claim over Speaker of the House Pelosi, even in the case of a disputed election lasting past January 20th. But I don't think the case is very strong for that constitutionally, because the 20th Amendment really provides the supplemental authority here, not Article 2, and it doesn't have that same officer's language and link and limitation that some read into Article 2 and thus read into the Presidential Succession Act. That said, that doesn't mean the Attorney General couldn't take a contrary view and issue the same sort of opinion binding in the executive branch into following Secretary of State Pompeo instead of the Speaker of the House Pelosi. And so you might end up in a scenario where people have to go to the courts to figure out what the right resolution of this statute is. Some people have said the courts may not be interested in getting involved in this, but I kind of suspect they would. You are dealing with the interpretation of a statute. That's an issue that more recently the Supreme Court has suggested it views as justiciable, not falling under political question doctrine sort of case, situation. Whereas, you know, earlier in American history, that those questions more often fell under political question doctrine as a sort of a dodge by the courts. And because there wouldn't be any way out otherwise. And so the court may feel kind of obligated to reach some sort of final resolution about how the statute should be read and whether it's consistent with the Constitution. But in the interim, you know, you would have potentially the executive branch following the edicts of one president, while the rest of the country believes, much of the rest of the country believes another person's properly president. Far from an optimal scenario, but nonetheless one that is at least theoretically possible. But again, it's not clear this is a super desirable outcome, because I think the odds that Secretary Pompeo would win that legal fight in the end are pretty low. And even then, it would only be a temporary position until they actually, Congress eventually has to resolve the 2020 election, which presumably it has to do at some point. So it just doesn't seem like a very big payoff, given the extraordinary step it would be and a potential political risk that would entail for the Republicans. And again, that's part of the reason why I think it's just so unlikely that's the route they ultimately choose to go.
So I just want to take this opportunity to note something that I think is kind of implicit in the really great explanation that Scott just gave, which is that even as we're talking now about things that are incredibly implausible, potentially impossible to actually come to pass in the next 6 weeks, we should still take away from this experience that there are lots of things about this process. Scott has talked about some of them in the context of presidential succession. I mentioned some of them about in the context of the Electoral Count Act. There are more in the context of the Electoral Count Act that should be fixed. This experience is bringing to the surface potential areas for reform. And so even if we don't find ourselves in one of the very ambiguous corners of the Electoral Count Act, you know, what happens if there are multiple slates of electors that have met the safe harbor deadline? What does executive really mean in the context of the Electoral Count Act? If you're really interested in these ambiguities, I'd refer you to any number of writings by Ned Foley, who's a great law professor at Ohio State. So there are lots of reasons to reform the Electoral Count Act. There are lots of things that we should probably address about presidential succession. And we should have that conversation inspired by what we're going through right now, even if we don't actually have any of these really implausible to impossible things come to pass.
We are going to leave it there. Molly Reynolds, Scott Anderson, thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our audio engineer this episode is Zachary Frank of Goat Rodeo. The Lawfare Podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell. And our promotional engine, who brings the Lawfare Podcast to thousands of new listeners, is you. So share the Lawfare Podcast, tweet about it, upvote it on Reddit, pin it on Pinterest, make TikTok videos about it if you have downloaded TikTok, which you should not do. Our music is, as always, performed by award-winning journalist Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.